Deutsche Welle, Spotlight on Europe.
Many thanks for joining us here on Spotlight on Europe. It's always a pleasure to have you on board as we take a look at major events here in Europe, but from an African perspective. My name is Jane Nyinge, and of course, we've got a lot lined up for you, including the suspension of Catalonia's bid for independence from Spain.
There's a kind of uneasy calm at the moment. We're not seeing quite the tension that we've been seeing over the last 3 or 4 weeks, which has been enormous, that tension between Madrid and Catalonia. But there is a feeling that this problem isn't going away. It's still there. It hasn't been resolved. And the underlying hostility between the two sides is still there.
And we'll get to hear the difficulties of deciding who to give the coveted Nobel Peace Prize. Well, for these stories and much more, please stick around for the next 30 minutes. We start off in Spain, where in recent weeks we've seen both pro- and anti-independence rallies in Barcelona. On Tuesday night, the president of Catalonia, Charles Puigdemont, appeared to declare independence and then suspended that declaration immediately afterwards. Then on Wednesday, Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy said the Catalan government had 8 days to drop its bid for independence. Our reporter Lauren Fryer hit the streets of Madrid to hear how Spaniards outside Catalonia see this conflict.
When she saw TV reports about some of her countrymen rallying for independence, 84-year-old Maria Feijó Grande went out and bought a Spanish flag and draped it over her balcony in Madrid.
No estoy de acuerdo. Las banderas las pongo cua, si tuviera dos...
I don't agree with what's happening in Catalonia. So if I had more flags, I'd put up another one, two or even three.
Several of her neighbors have done the same, and Maria's barrio is suddenly a sea of red and yellow Spanish flags, even more than when Spain won the World Cup. This time, it's a show of unity against part of the country, Catalonia, breaking away.
Está fuera de la ley. Entonces, todo lo que sea fuera de la ley.
They're breaking the law. We all voted and ratified the Spanish Constitution in 1978. They can't just change their minds now.
Catalonia did approve the Spanish Constitution a generation ago, but now the region is ruled by separatists, who defied court rulings and held a banned independence referendum October 1st. 90% voted for secession, but turnout was low.
Muy mal, porque yo nací el 36, no, el 33.
María, like many madrileños, believes that would be a disaster.
Mi padre estuvo en guerra. Muy mal.
It would be very bad, because I was born in 1933. I remember the Spanish Civil War. My father had to go fight. We also had Basque separatists, the ETA terror group. I've lived through it all.
She wants unity at all costs. Don't fool us. Catalonia is part of Spain. Tens of thousands of people chanted last weekend in Madrid.
Golpista, I don't know.
Protesters Ana García and her husband Juan Manuel Duran accuse Catalan leaders of staging a coup and want them arrested. As police units from all over Spain are redeployed to Catalonia to maintain order there, there have been send-off parades. Where townspeople yell, A por ellos, like, go get them, as if they're going off to war. Emilio Silva is the president of Spain's Association for Historical Memory, a group that exhumes mass graves from the Spanish Civil War and dictatorship that followed. The war pitted neighbors against each other, and those feelings are still raw 80 years on. Any challenge to Spain's unity, especially from within, inspires a fierce backlash, he says.
Cuando ya se estaba muriendo, Franco le dijo que solo le pedía una cosa, mantener España unida.
On his deathbed in 1975, the dictator Francisco Franco had one last order: keep Spain united. This is like an obsession. It's made some people suspicious of devolving powers to Spain's autonomous regions.
Just when you thought there was little middle ground here, a small, if noisy, demonstration broke out this past Saturday in Madrid.
Thank you.
where people waved white flags and unfurled a banner that said, Hablamos, let's talk. Marco Alvarez is a Madrileño in that crowd. He wants the Spanish government to explain why it wants Catalans to stay united with Spain, to counter the independence movement with reason, not with more nationalism.
I think the referendum should have been legal, but campaigned heavily for the no. But the way they handled it has led to this violence, to this confrontation, and now we have never been so tense.
And the tension appears only to be growing. Lauren Freyer, DW, Madrid.
Now, as you earlier heard, Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy has given the Catalan government until 16th of this month to drop its bid for independence. Helen Cine spoke to our correspondent in Spain, Guy Hedgeco, and he starts by explaining if Rajoy's ultimatum was likely to raise tensions between Madrid and Barcelona or offer a way out of this crisis.
Well, in theory, it offers a way out of the crisis because, you know, there's always a possibility that the Catalan president Puigdemont says, well, I didn't issue a declaration of independence, or he says that he did, but then he wants to retract it as the Spanish government is requesting. There's that possibility, but it looks unlikely. So there's a kind of uneasy calm at the moment. And we're not seeing quite the tension that we've been seeing over the last 3 or 4 weeks, which has been enormous, that tension between Madrid and Catalonia. Things are slightly calmer right now as we wait for the response from Carles Puigdemont. But there is a feeling that this problem isn't going away. It's still there. It hasn't been resolved. And the underlying hostility between the two sides is still there.
Well, as you just pointed out on Tuesday, Puigdemont, he appeared to declare independence and then suspend that declaration immediately afterwards. Up until now, he's been quite resolute in his plans for the region to go it alone. So is this a climb down? And what factors may have influenced it?
Well, there was a huge amount of expectation ahead of Puigdemont's announcement. There was expectation on his own side, his own supporters, who wanted to see a kind of a very pure independence declaration, you know, something unambiguous that said to the world, Catalonia is independent. But on the other hand, there were a lot of factors holding him back from that. First of all, there was the Spanish government threatening to take quite serious and swift action if he did declare independence. There were financial factors. In the days prior to his announcement, a number of big Catalan companies had announced that they were moving their legal base out of the region to elsewhere in Spain because they were worried about the political climate. That was clearly playing a role in all of this and worrying him and people in his own party. And then there was also the fact that Europe was looking at all this, that the international community was watching. Donald Tusk, the president of the European Council, made a very passionate plea just hours before Puigdemont made his announcement, asking him not to declare independence. And there's a feeling that may have had quite a strong influence on the final declaration, which, let's face it, was pretty ambiguous. And a lot of people were left scratching their heads after it. So there was a feeling that this wasn't a full-on declaration of independence. It was something that was designed to appease both sides to a certain extent. And as a result, it was rather confusing in the end.
You mentioned Donald Tusk there, the president of the European Council. And German Chancellor Angela Merkel has also stressed the importance of Spanish unity. But should the EU be actively mediating, given the implications of this crisis for the entire bloc?
This is clearly a very tricky issue for the EU. And the Catalan independence movement is constantly talking about how important the EU is to it. It sees itself as a pro-European movement, and it's always dismissed claims that if it did declare independence or if it did properly break away from Spain, that it would stop being a member of the EU and would have to apply for membership again. That's always been an argument by the unionist side, saying if you leave, then you'll have to reapply for membership, you lose the currency, you lose EU membership. And the pro-independence camp is acutely aware of the fact that Europe is watching. And Carles Puigdemont has made a number of appeals for mediation, specifically from European leaders. And he seems to be rather dismayed at the lack of response from the European Union to his appeals for mediation. But I think it's a difficult one for countries like Germany or France and so on, for them to get involved, because they don't want to be seen to be stepping on the toes of Mariano Rajoy, who so far has appeared to be very reluctant to see other European countries get involved in what he insists is a Spanish domestic issue. So clearly, you know, Angela Merkel isn't going to want to annoy Rajoy by suddenly wading in. And it's a very difficult one.
So what's the mood like now in Barcelona? I mean, do independent supporters there feel let down by Puigdemont's announcement on Tuesday night?
I mean, in terms of how the independent supporters feel about Puigdemont's announcement, I think it's rather complicated and nuanced. I think many of them are trying to put a brave face on it. People I've spoken to, for example, in some of the civic groups that have been supporting independence have been saying, well, you know, we would have wanted a full-on declaration of independence, but what could he do, you know, especially with Europe watching us and kind of pressuring for him not to do that? And they've been saying that, you know, basically he did what he had to do. But there is a political party within the Catalan independence movement called the CUP, and they're an anti-capitalist group. They're quite small, but they're key in all of this because they are propping up the Catalan government. They allow it to govern in the Catalan parliament with the seats that they have. And they seem to be pretty unhappy with the announcement he gave. And they said that it was an opportunity that had been missed. And they said that the announcement he gave was not what they're expecting at all. So if they end up withdrawing their support from Puigdemont and his party and his coalition in the parliament, then that could bring down the Catalan government and lead to Catalan elections, and that could lead to a whole sort of redrawing of the Catalan political landscape, potentially.
Well, I mean, obviously the crisis will continue to unfold. I know it's difficult to say, but could it escalate into a far more serious standoff involving the military there?
At the moment, a lot will depend on how the Spanish government responds. If it is unhappy with the response that it gets from Carlos Puigdemont to its request for clarification about his declaration of independence or supposed declaration of independence, if it's unhappy with that, then what we're expecting is for the Spanish government to trigger this article in the Constitution, Article 155, which would allow Madrid to take over Catalonia's autonomous powers and essentially introduce direct rule from Madrid. And that is seen as a pretty drastic step. That article in the Constitution has never been used before, so we're in slightly uncharted waters here. And that would be seen as very dramatic on Rajoy's part. Now, he seems to be moving towards taking that step. The big question then is what would be the reaction from the Catalan independence movement? Then you're looking at how, for example, the Catalan police behave. Do they behave as loyal to the Catalan government, or do they behave as loyal to the Spanish government? Logistical issues like that could end up being key as to whether there is some kind of violence or further escalation on the ground.
Our Spain correspondent Guy Hedgeco speaking to Helen Sini. Well, if you've just joined us, this is Spotlight on Europe coming to you from Bonn, Germany. And yes, you can keep talking to us on our Facebook page, DW Africa, or leave us a voice note on our WhatsApp. It's another year of disappointment for Africa after Kenyan writer Ngugi wa Thiong'o missed out on the Nobel Prize in Literature after Swedish Academy settled for British novelist Kazuo Ishiguro. Ishiguro was awarded for his emotionally impactful novel. Of course, it's the Peace Prize, which tends to get most attention. But there is a feeling sometimes the Norwegian Nobel Committee doesn't always get it right. A case in point is former Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi and her handling of the Rohingya crisis. So how do you avoid giving the most coveted Peace Prize to people who later might prove not worthy of it? Lars Bevenga has been finding out in Oslo.
This is the Great Hall of the Norwegian Nobel Institute. If you've ever watched the announcement of the Nobel Peace Prize, you'll have seen the door and lectern I'm stood in front of now. It's where the committee chair each year faces the world media to announce the lucky winner or winners. Often a very popular prize, but not always.
Nothing that has happened to me in public life has moved me more than this award, when I shall receive
the 1973 prize to then U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and his North Vietnamese counterpart Lee Duc Tho was controversial at the time, nearly impossible to understand today. The Vietnam War was not over yet, and Kissinger had secretly been carpet bombing neighboring Cambodia for some time. Other prizes, like the one to Barack Obama, only months into his presidency, were seen as woefully premature at best. Olav Njølstad is the Norwegian Nobel Committee's permanent secretary. While it's impossible to predict what laureates might do or fail to do in the future, he agrees there are always risks which should be taken into consideration.
I think it's somewhat problematic to award the prize only for aspirational motives. So there should always be something that has already been achieved. I think we can see that there is more risk into giving a prize both to active politicians, state leaders, and to someone if the most important part of their motivation is aspirational.
I will now call upon Michael, Alexander and Kim Aris to come forward to receive the gold medal and the diploma on behalf of their wife and mother, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate 1991, Aung San Suu Kyi.
26 years ago, few seemed more deserving of the Peace Prize than Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi, then under house arrest in her home country. Now head of government, her failure to address what many call ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya minority from Myanmar has led to calls for her Peace Prize to be revoked. Henrik Urdal is head of the Peace Research Institute, Oslo.
Obviously, she hasn't lived up to the expectations of a Nobel laureate. The discussion about sort of revoking the prize is not terribly useful, though. Technically, you cannot do that. Also, the Peace Prize now provides sort of a platform to also criticize her inaction and denial when it comes to the case of the Rakhine and the Rohingya minority in Myanmar.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2017 to the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN.
This year's Peace Prize is perhaps more future-proof and less controversial, but there are critics. Nuclear states and NATO members argue the Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, is the way to go, not an outright ban. The chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, Berit Reiss-Andersen, won't be swayed, though.
The nuclear states, as defined in the NPT treaty, they have a monopoly by the treaty on nuclear weapons, but they do not have a monopoly on the nuclear debate. Peoples of the world fear nuclear weapons, and it is an irony that they are there to protect us. I believe that the public opinion will eventually force also nuclear states to revitalize this process of disarmament.
The Nobel Peace Prize will never please everyone. Many applauded the 2010 award to Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo. Beijing was incensed and cut diplomatic ties with Norway for 6 years. Yet, if the Nobel Peace Prize is to continue to be relevant in the world, debate is the oxygen the Norwegian Nobel Committee needs. So expect more surprises and controversy in years to come. Lars Bevanger, DW, at the Norwegian Nobel Institute in Oslo.
Well, given the escalating tensions between the US and North Korea, some good news that this year's Nobel Peace Prize will go to the anti-nuclear group ICAN. It's a global citizen movement that has pushed for treaties banning nuclear weapons. But there is perhaps another hero forgotten in all this, Stanislav Petrov. He was a Soviet officer, sometimes known as the man who saved the world for an act that prevented nuclear Armageddon. The world recently learned that Petrov passed away early this year at the age of 77. Our Moscow-based producer Charles Mainz once visited Petrov and has this look back at his achievements.
Dial the clock back to 1983, to a real low in U.S.-Russian relations.
To ignore the facts of history and the aggressive impulses of an evil empire.
President Ronald Reagan declared the USSR the evil empire.
The United States claim a Soviet fighter shot down the Korean airliner.
The Soviets' downing of a civilian Korean airliner sparked international outrage, and hardliners in the Kremlin were convinced a U.S. attack was imminent. It was at this point a 44-year-old colonel named Stanislav Petrov began his assignment at the Serpukhov 15 nuclear monitoring station outside Moscow, feeling lucky as can be.
Honestly, it was beyond my wildest dreams. I envied myself when I got this job. It was working with the latest technology, working with satellites. And from that system, the fate of the country rested on it. I felt like I was right where I needed to be.
Petrov was in charge of early warning systems in an underground bunker that looked just how you might imagine, a cavernous dark room, a giant screen with satellite images of the globe, the red and green lights flashing. Petrov recalled how in monitoring U.S. test launches, he and others developed a certain admiration for their American counterparts on the other side of the world.
We didn't see them as our enemy. They were like our rivals, like you have in sports.
But like any game, it got tedious the more they played. Petrov says week after week, day in, day out, it was the same routine. 12-hour shifts staring at the screen until September 26, 1983, when...
Opa, start.
The sirens went off. The U.S. had launched the long-feared nuclear strike. Petrov says his crew was jolted, but not panicked. They'd trained for this, and he quickly began checking the computer readings.
Нормально, 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 нормально.
The data seemed accurate. Only then the screen showed three, then five, nuclear weapons on their way. With every indication showing this was the real thing, Petrov knew he had to inform his superiors quickly if the Soviet leadership was to launch a response. And this is where his story takes an unexpected turn. After five excruciating minutes, Petrov concluded that something just didn't add up. In the end, he recorded the incident as a system malfunction, which of course it was, though Petrov said his decision was based more on gut feeling than logic.
Причины Третьей мировой войны я не буду. Еще. Было такое мнение.
I told myself I will not be the cause of World War III. I won't. Simple as that. If they punish me, they punish me. If they imprison me, okay. But something told me that over there, on the other side of the ocean, there are people just like me, and they probably don't want war.
Petrov was never honored by the Soviets for his role in averting catastrophe, but in the post-Soviet 90s, Petrov's story came to light in the West. He was awarded international peace prizes, though he always rejected the idea he was some sort of pacifist. And until his death, he lived out his life in a spare, cramped apartment outside Moscow, fielding constant calls from journalists asking him to retell the story of that night in September 1983. Petrov would claim he never cared for the spotlight, though he did occasionally enjoy some of the perks of his celebrity. He once recounted visiting an American nuclear monitoring station during a trip to the U.S. The lights, the controls, they were all in English, but instantly familiar. Petrov was, of course, now in the other team's locker room, but he said, to him, it felt like home. Charles Mainz, DW, Moscow.
And now to our news roundup, and the Netherlands finally has a new government 7 months after elections. A new coalition has been formed after a record 209 days of bargaining, which will steer the country towards the political right. Gabriel Borod has the details in this roundup of European news.
It hasn't taken this long to form a Dutch government since 1977. Four parties will form a new coalition that will only have a majority of one seat in the lower house. Mark Rutte, from the business-friendly liberal VVD party, will head his third government since coming to power in 2010. Other cabinet posts are yet to be announced. Negotiations to form a coalition were fraught with tough debates over migration, taxation, and euthanasia. The four parties have agreed to limit financial allowances for asylum seekers in the first 2 years of their stay, though the country plans to admit several hundred refugees more per year. The new government also plans a significant overhaul of the tax system, with a cut in income taxes worth around 6 billion euros that will benefit the wealthy and middle classes. Corporate tax will be lowered and tax breaks for homeowners will be scaled back. It's hoped these measures will make the Netherlands more attractive for international companies, though unions are concerned they will raise the cost of living. Higher taxes will be introduced for polluters, and all five coal-fired energy plants will be closed down by 2030 in an attempt to lower carbon dioxide emissions. However, while the coalition may have ambitious plans, analysts are already warning that it could be an uneasy and fragile political marriage. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has lashed out at Turkish prosecutors, calling their demand for lengthy jail sentences for human rights activists completely incomprehensible. She was referring specifically to a proposed 15-year sentence by Turkish prosecutors for Peter Steutner, a German activist. He was arrested along with nine other activists at a workshop run by Amnesty International in July. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, a German journalist and translator went on trial outside Istanbul, charged with membership of a banned radical leftist group. Mesale Tolu faces 15 years in jail if convicted. The German-Turkish correspondent of Germany's daily Die Welt, Dennis Yücel, is also facing trial on charges of terror propaganda. Berlin believes that a total of 11 Germans are imprisoned in Turkey, facing possible political charges. However, German officials fear that the actual figure could be much higher. There's been a drastic decline in press freedom and civil rights in Turkey since last year's failed coup. According to the P24 Press Freedom Group, there are 170 journalists behind bars in Turkey. In the Czech Republic, the frontrunner to become prime minister in the forthcoming elections has been charged with fraud. Andrej Babiš, a billionaire and former finance minister, has denied misusing EU subsidy funds worth 2 million euros a decade ago. He says the charges are politically motivated to prevent him from winning power. The case prompted the Czech parliament to strip Babiš of his parliamentary immunity in September. EU authorities are also investigating the case. Babiš was fired earlier this year as finance minister over unexplained business dealings. However, he's expected to win a new parliamentary mandate in elections in less than a week. That would renew his immunity, and parliament would have to vote again to lift it to allow the prosecution to go ahead. Babiš's popularity has also stayed high despite claims he was an agent for the secret police during the communist era in former Czechoslovakia. His ANO party is leading in the opinion polls ahead of the vote. The Greek government has passed a law which will allow people to legally change their gender from the age of 15 without having a medical operation. Until now, those wanting to change their gender identity have had to first undergo sex change surgery and undergo psychiatric assessment. The new law will allow people to change the gender listed on their identity cards and other official documents following a simple declaration in court. The transgender community and human rights groups have hailed the passing of the bill, and Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras insisted the bill was a question of extending basic human rights to a segment of society that had been marginalized for too long. But there's been considerable controversy surrounding it. It's been condemned by the Greek Orthodox Church as immoral and as a monstrosity by right-wing politicians. The main opposition conservative New Democratic Party voted against the bill, saying it was a sloppy attempt to divert public attention from Greece's financial problems.
Thank you, Gabriel Borod, for that roundup. Why? Well, it's a wrap. That's where we end today's show. Don't forget, if you missed any bit of the show or you want to listen it again, you can visit our website, DW Africa, or our Facebook page. Remember, we continue looking forward to your feedback. Keep them coming to our email address, which is feedback.africa@dw.com, or get hold of us on our Facebook page. On behalf of the entire team here in Bonn, Germany, my name is Jane Nyinge. Thank you so much for your time.